Thanks for joining us. Dr. Terry Walls talks to the first-year medical students about her experience as a patient. Dr. Walls was just begun the dietary and lifestyle interventions that would ultimately lead a dramatic recovery. Note, at this time, Dr. Walls is unaware that her function will soon be improving.
I'm Dr. Walls, Terry Walls, and I'm giving the lecture today, The Patient Experience Through the Eyes of a Physician Colleague. And what I'm going to talk to you about is an intensely personal story. It is my story of my chronic progressive illness, how long it took to get a diagnosis, and what it felt like during that time. I'll also share with you the insights that my illness gave me as a physician. So the story begins when I was sitting in the chairs just like you are right now. I began having twinges of discomfort in this temple, last a few days. Then I'd come back and it'd be this temple, last a few days. There's a lot to do, a lot of tests to deal with, a lot of clinical rotation, so I of course ignored that. That would continue to come and go throughout training. Finally, when I was in practice, the first couple of years, it became much more intense. And I finally went to see a physician colleague, a neurologist, who did a thorough exam and told me I had essentially occipital neuralgia, which meant that the nerves innervating the back of my scalp were confused and were sending intermittently sharp electrical pain. It's like the pain receptor got on full on. If you do that to any of your pain receptors, it's perceived as intense electrical pain. He started me on Tegretol, which didn't stop the pain, but it dialed it back, and it made it more tolerable. And I was profoundly grateful, because I'd already been stuck in the on position for 6 weeks. Then I got a drug rash, and we had to stop it. I tried a few other drugs, none of which worked. But after another 2 weeks, the episode stopped. And I realized I was just going to have to grit my teeth and bear the pain when these episodes would come. Episodes were so intense that at times, you know, I'd be talking and I couldn't speak because the pain interrupted cognition, basically. And then I could go on speaking. It got to be so severe at times my knees would buckle because the pain was so severe. But there wasn't much, you know, wasn't much I could do because I'd already gone to see the best neurologist in town and he couldn't do much, so I just toughed it out. A couple years later, you know, I'm still young and energetic, so after work I'm out rollerblading. Because I'm in northern Wisconsin, I like cross-country skiing, and so I train year-round and I was doing roller skiing down a deserted blacktop road. And, you know, I'm zipping along about 5 miles out, and this pickup zooms out past me, startled the heck out of me. And I sort of looked around, and then I covered my eye. Yep, looks fine. Cover my right eye, and the world is black. I see a very dim light at the horizon. Otherwise, it's black. I'm blind in my left eye. Well, that was a very scary, unsettling feeling. And I'm going through the differential. Okay, could this be a stroke? No, I'm pretty young for that. I don't have any heart disease. Could it be a retinal infarction? Well, that doesn't make any sense. I'm pretty young. But I'm still blind. And I take off my roller skis and I begin walking the 5 miles back to my car back home. And by the time I get back, I'm checking my eyes again, deciding should I go to the ER. So I cover my eyes, and I'm seeing pretty much the same out of both eyes. So I, you know, go back to my apartment, and I do a quick neuro exam, check my taste, my visual acuity, my sensation, my reflexes. Everything seems fine. But I said, well, heck, I'm not going to waste the money and the time going to the ER. I might as well call my neurologist in the morning. But my neurologist is gone, so I see one of his partners. And he, of course, says, you know, just come straight up to the office. I'll see you right now. Does a thorough exam. My neuro exam by then is completely normal, including my eye exam. He sends me for a carotid echo, ultrasound of my carotid arteries, an ultrasound of my heart valves, and to the eye doctors, the retina specialist, to figure out, okay, so what was going on. The carotid was okay. I have a mitral valve prolapse, not a big deal. Otherwise, my heart is fine. The retinal guy says the retina is fine, visual fields are fine, visual acuity is fine. You must have autonomic dysfunction of the retinal blood flow. And my neurologist says, don't worry about it. Just try not to rev up your heart cardiac output quite so much, because apparently your retina on your left eye can't dilate quite as well, and so it gets a little bit starved of blood. Well, I'm thinking, yeah, this sounds like crap to me. But, you know, I like all these guys. They're my partners, and, you know, they were very thorough. But I go over to our medical library, try and look up retinal dysfunction, retinal blood flow dysfunction. There's no such diagnosis that I can find. And I intermittently think about, well, should I go, like, back to my alma mater, back to the University of Iowa, see what's going on? But, you know, life is busy, so I don't. I mean, after all, I did get a thorough, aggressive workup. And I'm thinking maybe my colleagues think this is functional in my head. So a couple weeks later, I decide I'm going to go for roller skiing again. And so I'm going a couple miles, check my eyes, it's okay. Go a couple more miles, check my eyes, it's okay. 5 miles, check my eyes. Damn, it's blind. I can't see again. So the good news is I'm not crazy. The bad news is I'm blind in my left eye. But I'm not quite as frightened this time. I take off my skis and I walk back, and by the time I get back, I can see. Now, you might think the thing to do would be go back to your doctor and say, okay, it happened again. But, you know, I didn't bother. It's like, okay, I'd already gotten the big workup. I just did adapt. I didn't push myself as hard when I was skiing, when I was running. I learned if I was racing, if I raced too hard, I couldn't see very well. My visual acuity dropped markedly, and my perception of color changed. My skis, which had these beautiful blue stripes on them, suddenly looked very different if I was racing too hard. But, of course, I'm a primary care doc in internal medicine. I'm not a neurologist. I didn't clue into what that might be meaning. You know, some of the things I could have done that would have been very insightful, pick up more disability insurance, that would have been good. Pick up more life insurance, that would have been good. But I didn't do that. I just kept, you know, plugging along. Still had intermittent face pains. I had two kids. I suppose the stress of having two young kids maybe adds to it, but I have more face pains, more unpleasant. I finally get back to neurology, and I see my third neurologist, same group, and this neurologist says, how about we send you to the pain clinic for a nerve block? Now, I've been enduring these horrific bouts of nerve pain. And I have to admit, when I first started, that was before gabapentin or Lyrica. And there really was no medication that worked for neuropathic pain. So a lot had happened in those 10 years. But this was profoundly grateful. So I went to the pain clinic. And to do a nerve block, what they have to do, can I have your head? Okay, thank you, very kind. So they have to sort of feel the head, get the landmarks, and numb me up here and here. Now, to do that, that means touching me. Now, the problem, that's all, you can have your head back. So the problem with that is any sensory input, light, sound, air on my cheek, induces another trigger of this neuropathic pain. So this guy had to, and I knew he had to touch me to do this, and somehow I had to not jerk. That took every bit of concentration that I had to not jerk. And so he finds the spot where the nerve, he touches that, which was even more horrifically painful. Somehow I have to not jerk, he injects it, which, you know, is really over the top with pain. But then 5 minutes later, the pain is gone. It was like, oh my God, no wonder people worship anesthesiologists. Oh my God, this was just, is the first time in my life that this horrific bouts of pain had been curtailed. And then they wanted me to take gabapentin to try and keep this from coming back. So I did. And, you know, after a couple weeks of being on gabapentin, when I was out trying to roller ski, or actually this was during the winter, so I was trying to ski, my balance was off. So what did I do? Now, mind you, that pain, the pain from the neuropathic pain is worse than broken bones, worse than surgery, worse than child labor without an epidural. It's bad. And I'd finally gotten the miraculous drug that kept it at bay. But I was having, you know, some balance problems. I couldn't ski as well. And so what did I do? I stopped my drug. And what happened 2 weeks later? My pain came back. I had to go back to the pain clinic, got another injection, which again was just as horrible as the first one because they had to touch me. You know, I white knuckle hanging onto the table trying to not move while they were doing the injection. Started the gabapentin. And 4 weeks later, I stopped it again. Now, I did that for the next 3 years. And I learned an immense amount about adherence. When you are in the throes of misery, you take the drugs, you put up with them, whatever the side effects are, and you're profoundly grateful for the benefit. But when the benefit is there, and you're feeling good, that benefit is now assumed, and all you see are the side effects, however minimal or great they are. And so for years, what I did was I would stop my gabapentin. My neurologist would say, you really need to stay on it all the time. But I was young, I was healthy, I was strong. I wasn't ready to admit that I had a chronic disease. But eventually I did. I stayed on the gabapentin continuously. And then my pain came back. Even though I'd accepted that I had to be on the gabapentin, even though I accepted I was going to have problems with my balance, it came back. I was very depressed. And, you know, I was referred then to the world-famous Mayo Clinic. The neurologist there said, yep, you got occipital neuralgia. This is going to be progressive. You need to stay on the gabapentin. And you'll need intermittent nerve blocks. And yes, this is a progressive illness. So it kept increasing the gabapentin dose. But I learned a great deal about patient adherence. And one of the things I learned was to always ask my patients, what drugs are you actually taking? I know people often quit their drugs or have drugs they want to quit. What have you quit and what is it that you want to quit? That was very revealing. People, in fact, will tell you what they've quit and what they want to get rid of. And often when I would work with them to taper them off those drugs, I would discover that they were right, they didn't need the drugs, and they were more troublesome. Or that the patient was, in fact, a whole lot more miserable off the drug, and then it was easier for them to stay on it. Because in the bottom line, the patient needs to experience a difference to stay on it. So my face, I have accommodated my life, so I'm not as athletic, so my heart isn't going up so high, so I'm not blind anymore, which is good. But I'm still having these progressively worse episodes of very unpleasant pain. And then in 2000, irrational person that I am, I started working on my MBA because I decided physicians, if we're going to run healthcare, we need to have masters in business administration so we can talk money along with the accountants and not be blown away by their razzle-dazzle. But I suppose that upped my stress, you know, trying to be a mom and get an MBA and run a practice. And I began to notice that my left foot, I seemed to be stumbling on my toes a lot. And if I walked for more than half an hour, it just, my left leg wasn't working quite as well. But I ignored it because, you know, I had a lot to do. But my partner was saying, no, you need to see someone. Well, after about 7 months, clever person that she is, she said, you know, let us take a nice long morning walk, about 3 miles, and I could hardly walk by the time we got back. So it was obvious that there was something wrong, and I really couldn't put it off anymore. So I called a friend who agreed to see me the next morning, and she was, so I got up, walked a long time before, just to be sure that would be something abnormal when she did the exam, and it was very apparent that there was something very wrong with my left leg. So my friend would try to be, you know, sort of low-key, minimized, and say, well, we'll get an MRI of your spine. Maybe you've got a nerve root that's going on here. You might need some back surgery. I don't think it's going to be that big of a deal. However, in my heart, I knew, like, oh, hell, this is a much bigger deal than that. I couldn't sleep at night. I knew there was trouble. I got my MRI. It was, you know, sort of boring thing. The MRIs were sort of old and clunky then, sort of a loud, noisy thing. Took about 20 minutes to get the scan. And then I met my friend, and the radiologist went over the film together. He said, well, there's evidence of some old athletic activity here, but nothing that would explain your weakness in your left leg. So I said, you probably need to see a neurologist. And I went then back to work. At 5 o'clock, as I was about to leave, go home, my colleague in neurology called me and said, hey, Terry, are you done? I said, well, yeah, I am. I want to see you now. And I tried to convince him, no, why don't you wait till morning? No, I really want to see you now. So I go up and see him and tell him the story. He does the exam. I'm thinking, okay, it's a normal neuro exam, no big deal. And he says, you know, you have an upgoing Babinski. I don't know if you guys know what that is, but you strike the bottom. I'd take your foot, but, well, scratch the bottom of the foot and the big toe goes up. That means there is something wrong in your spinal cord or your brain, so you have a myelopathy. Well, that's not very good. And then he says, I want to do an MRI tonight to decide if I have to admit you. Now, that was not feeling very good. I was supposed to go pick my kids up from daycare. My partner's working in urgent care. I had already submitted my resignation. I was planning to move here in about 6 weeks. So I called my partner. She figured out how to get the kids. And I went down to the MR scanner. It was the same text. And we were laughing and joking the first time. Now this time, you can see the level of concern on their faces. It looks very much like your faces, you know, very sober, very, this is not good. I'm laying in the scanner. I've got 45 minutes. So what am I doing? I'm adding up my life insurance. I'm adding up my disability insurance, and the numbers are not as high as I would like them to be. And I'm thinking about the fact I have tendered my resignation. I was supposed to move in 6 weeks. And so have I just taken my family from a life of financial security to insecurity? Because my neurology colleague had been very frank. He said, you know, this could be bad, or this could be really, really bad, Terry. So I was thinking about really, really bad. And it wasn't dying that was really, really bad. It was becoming disabled, unable to work, lingering, having high-cost medical bills, lack of insurance, and facing the same kind of terrifying uncertainties that my patients face when I'm trying to work up what's going on, when they may be going from an employed, secure situation to disabled, loss of insurance, loss of home. And so I had to spend the next 2 weeks feeling that same level of terror. And what I learned during that time is that the most important thing isn't necessarily life. The most important thing isn't necessarily living or dying. I was praying for a rapidly fatal diagnosis. That's what I wanted. I wanted a rapidly fatal diagnosis. I did not want the lingering, disabling diagnosis. I did not want to lose my ability to care for my family financially, emotionally, spiritually, physically. And if I couldn't do that, I'd rather be dead. I certainly didn't want to become a burden. And that was very enlightening to have gotten to have that difficult period. So I went through lots of tests. Some of them hurt a whole lot. Give these little needles, put them in your back, and they put some current, a little bit, see how long it takes to get to a patch on your ankle. They keep turning it up. And if you have a block, it takes more current, so it hurts more. And then you get these flashing lights. That one was not painful. That looked at how long it takes for the image to go up from your retina back to your occipital nerves or occipital lobes. At least that one wasn't painful. And lots of blood tests, etc. Then a spinal tap, and I got to have the happy privilege of a spinal headache and a blood patch afterwards. And that was at a point when it wasn't a problem to look up your own lab results. So while I was home, stuck with the spinal tap and the spinal headache, I looked up my lab results every day. Not in. Oh, they're in. And it was positive for oligomans in the spinal fluid. That meant that I had multiple sclerosis. So now you'd think that looking it up once would be enough. But, you know, I suppose being an internal medicine doc, I have a certain amount of obsessive compulsive behavior. And so I had to look them up probably about 10 times that day just in case they would change. You know, who knows why I would do that, but I did. The next day, my neurologist called me to tell me that, yes, I had MS, and that I should come back in the following week, and he'd tell me more about it. So when I came in, he explained that, yes, this is a progressive disease. It's unpredictable. I don't know what will happen in the next 10 years following diagnosis. Half of people who are diagnosed are unable to work because of severe fatigue disability. About a third have serious limitations with their walking and will need a wheelchair, scooter, canes, walkers. Some do well. We think taking one of the ABC drugs may decrease the chance of more acute relapses of symptoms. We aren't sure, but we think it may lengthen the time to severe disability. So I took those drugs. I took Copaxone. I had one transient relapse in 2001. So you'd think that was a success, because the goal was to have no acute relapses. But by 2004, my doc, life was difficult. Fatigue was very much a problem. Walking had become difficult. I was rearranging my day to minimize walking as best I could. My doc had a great observation. He wanted to know how I did in the afternoon. Was I using a cane? I said, no, of course not. He goes, so, you know, your walking's not very good late in the day. If people see you walking in the hospital or in Walgreens, would you rather that they were wondering if you have a problem with alcohol or using a cane? That was a good question. So then he also said, but you have such severe fatigue, I think it's time that you get a scooter. We talked a bit more, and then he said, no, maybe it'd be better if you got a tilt-recline wheelchair. That meant having to come out to the whole world and having to face all of my colleagues and friends who were going, oh, my God, Dr. Walls, what happened to you? And over again, you know. At that point, my future was pretty frightening to me. But I was committed that I was going to maintain optimism. So I was telling people over and over again that everything's fine. This will help with my fatigue. I'll continue as chief of primary care. Nothing needs to change. I didn't really believe that, but I thought, you know, if I was going to resign as chief of primary care, I had to pretend that everything would be fine. And lo and behold, by the end of the week, after having said that probably 100 times, yeah, I was feeling a whole lot better that, yes, I'd figured out things were going to be fine. I had the privilege of learning about chemotherapy. I took Novantrone, which is doses not as high as you'd take for breast cancer, but still high enough that I had neutropenia, I had refractory vomiting, my hair was markedly reduced, although I didn't have to shave my head, but markedly reduced. Went through 3 cycles, didn't seem to make any difference. So I said, okay, enough of that, I'm not doing that anymore. And continued my gradual decline. That was the point. And I tried Tysabri, which is that wonderful new designer drug that attacks your adhesion molecules, makes it difficult for lymphocytes to get into the brain, and markedly reduces acute relapses. God knows what it does for secondary progressive, but you know, life was bad, so I was happy to try it. Took a couple cycles, and then it was pulled from the market because people were dying. And I was switched to a transplant drug called Celcept. That was in 2005. And that was when I decided that standard medicine wasn't going to stop my disease. And the future was pretty clear. It was very hard to sit in a standard chair. I could not sit even 10 minutes in a chair like these. I had to use a special zero-gravity chair, recliner to work. Driving was increasingly difficult. I was spending more and more of my day fully reclined or laying down. So my future was very clear. I would be bedridden. The question was, how long was it going to take? And that was when I decided I would begin reading the literature. I'd log on to PubMed and start reading neuroimmunology, reading about neurodegenerative, and I began tinkering with my own healthcare. I would check in, tell my primary care doc, my neurologist, what I was doing, but I started redesigning my healthcare. Okay, am I good now? All right, God knows what I did. Okay, so by the summer of 2007, I was in my tilt-recline wheelchair. I could walk short distances in the morning. By the evening, I needed 2 canes to walk out to the car, to walk when I would get home between our kitchen to the bedroom. I would come back to the kitchen. Exhausted, sit back in the zero gravity chair, basically at horizontal, have supper, stay put there until I went to bed. That's how exhausted I was. Now, obviously, something has changed, but I'm not going to tell you about that just yet. That's lecture part two, when I'll speak with you about intensive directed nutrition in neuromuscular electrical stem. And I'll tell you in detail about the program and how you might use some of those concepts for your own personal health and for the health of your patients. This lecture is primarily about the descent into chronic disease and the insights from the chronic illness. So I'm going to stop my story there and open this up to conversation and inquiry about the experience of the decline. I'm not going to talk about my intervention that has had very unexpected results. We'll save that for the second lecture, which hopefully you guys will enjoy as well. Questions? Yes? No? Go ahead.
So by the time that day you saw your results, that you had all of the things, were you suspecting at that point that you
were going to have when I first started the workup for the foot drop, MS was not in the differential. Actually, at that point, I was thinking paraneoplastic syndrome when they said it wasn't a nerve root. By the time we were doing the spinal tap, I knew that was what was being, why it was done. Yes? Oh, I feel a great deal of empathy for them. When you have an autoimmune disease, it's typical for the patients to have 1 year to 20 years of misdiagnoses. And that's because, you know, we're beginning to understand, you guys are studying basic sciences, the physiology of the molecular basis of health. And when things begin to go wrong with that molecular processes, that will slowly damage the tissues, the organs, and depending on what the rate of damage, it will get classified into a diagnosis that I see in primary care, and I have some tools to work on. Between the beginning of the molecular boo-boos and the diagnosis are many, many years of misery for patients and the primary care docs who sees you coming in complaining of all these terrible headaches, malaise, pain, fatigue. I don't have a clue, and I can't stand it when you're in my schedule because I'm stressed out. And I just wish you would sort of, you know, either find another doc or get a diagnosis. I hate to say it, but that is sort of what often happens. And so it's predictable. I'm a little more empathetic, or a whole lot more empathetic, when people come in with chronic problems without a clear diagnosis. In my next lecture, I'll talk about different ways for us to think about those patients and what you can do to help their disordered molecular processes.
So yes? To follow up on that question, at what point would it have been?
Diagnosed?
Yeah.
When I was blind.
Oh, that early.
That early. And of course, had it been. Now, on the other hand, I should say, at that point, there was no treatment. So, you know, in the 1980s, you wouldn't have done much. And so there is a huge reluctance to give people a diagnosis for which you can't treat, for which you'll make me, at that point, uninsurable. It was okay. Now, what is too bad, I didn't have the insight to realize, like, you know, what the heck are you doing? You should be going out getting insurance while you can. Yes?
In the 1980s, fibromyalgia was
It wasn't.
Sorry?
Yeah, fibromyalgia wasn't a real diagnosis. It's all in your head.
Did you encounter any of that sentiment when talking to the physician about your pain?
Not for the occipital neuralgia. That was a very clear diagnosis and pretty clearly disabling. And the blindness, I have to admit, I had a thorough workup. They gave me a name, which I thought was sort of bogus. And so in the back of my head, I was wondering, God, I wonder if they think this is sort of functional in my head. And that may have added to why I had no desire to go back and say, you know what, it's still going on. Yes?
I was wondering how, like, you notice any difference with, like, interaction with your patients as far as them. Like, do they know that
you have MS?
Yeah.
Now because I talk about it, I lecture in the community, so lots of people are calling, wanting me to be their MS doctor. I have to say, look, I'm only in the VA, I only see traumatic brain injury, so no, that's not possible, but we do have a study we're working on. I think it's important to maintain some distance between myself and my patients, so I don't discuss my health issues. In my follow-up lecture, you will hear how I talk about the use of intensive nutrition and trying to improve people's molecular physiology. That I talk about a lot. But I don't think there's too much transference if I'm talking about my health issues taking care of you. It's not relevant, and so I keep that wall up. Yes? People who have drug dependency or are coming in. And I do see this a fair amount at the VA. There are people who have drug dependency who are coming in. We'll put them on a schedule. I will offer an inpatient referral for tapering off their current pain protocol and other means of dealing with their pain. I've also have found, now that I've shifted my thinking from specific diagnoses to molecular processes and having retaught myself basic physiology, blah, 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 that, in fact, when we focus on improving cellular physiology, treating the profound vitamin D deficiency, many of that much of that refractory severe pain markedly diminishes. So I've shifted how I take care of pain. I find it to be a much more effective means. And chronic narcs are not effective. Nor were they effective for my horrific pain. The only time that narcotics stopped my pain was when I was given enough narcotics that I was snowed and nearly apneic. So narcotics are not good for neuropathic pain. Yeah? Oh. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the other thing that's sort of funny, in the traumatic brain injury clinic where most of my practice is, and I'm very careful to not talk to my patients about my own health issues. The nurses who room the patients, however, are not. They'll say, "My God, you got to listen to this doctor. You wouldn't believe. She's spent years in a wheelchair. She's walking out from the stuff she does. You got to listen. She makes a difference." So they get the prep. You know, I keep my mouth shut, and I don't discuss my health issues, but apparently the nurses are setting up a lot of confidence. Go ahead. You know, has my experience made me a better physician? Absolutely. I have become profoundly grateful for my neuropathic pain, which I still have, by the way, and my multiple sclerosis and those years in the wheelchair. Without that, I would not have delved into functional medicine. I would not have been motivated to relearn all that biochem, cellular phys, neurophys, and I would not have the knowledge that I have now. So I am profoundly grateful. I also think it's had profound benefits to my family and my kids, who, during their formative years, had to take on real responsibility as their mother became profoundly disabled. So as young adults, they are far better equipped to deal with life. Because they didn't have, their chores weren't just made-up chores. They had, you know, they knew that they really had to help the family out. Yes? There were certainly difficult times. There's no doubt when things were going steadily downhill, trying to find the gift in my illness. One of the turning points was when actually I decided to begin lecturing the medical students about what, because when I first started this, I was in the wheelchair, and you know there was no, you know, happy ending to my story. You know, it's interesting. Many of my colleagues said, "You are what? You're going to, that is much too intimate of a revelation to make publicly." But the beauty of doing that was I was claiming the gift of the things that I learned as a human being, as a physician, and sharing that. And so with every illness, helping patients identify for them and their family what is the gift. You'll see in your cancer rotations, many patients talking about the gift that cancer has been to them, because it's helped them reconcile family members. It's helped them trim away what was irrelevant in their lives and provide a deeper meaning. That is, I think, a very important role for us, whatever the patient's illness, to help them find what is the gift in that circumstance. And there are gifts. Even when I was going downhill and all I saw was the future of being bedridden, there were gifts for my family and gifts to share. Certainly my kids at times yelled and were very upset that I was so lazy. My partner was depressed and too irritable with my son, and I was too irritable with my daughter. But we managed to keep talking through that. One of the things that helped was I would focus on, if my biggest role in life was to prepare my kids to be successful as adults, the life skills they were getting working through my illness was quite a gift. But there are plenty of days that I was feeling bad and I was depressed and crying and terribly afraid of what being bedridden would do to me. And plenty of days I was thinking, you know, damn, I wish I could just sort of quit, you know, sink down to the bottom and quit breathing and it'd be done. But I look at my kids like, well, you know, that's not a lesson I want to teach them. So get up, go to work, and do the best you can. But it's all about framing, helping your patients find the frame around their life and their illness that gives them meaning to keep getting up every day and facing their life. Yes? Yes. Well, the reason I can walk today, the reason that I can bike 5 miles today, is I'm convinced on the basis of the interventions I will tell you about in 3 weeks. So when I decided that, okay, the only hope I have is to look through the seeds of basic science literature to design interventions that will someday be the basis of care. Because it takes 10 to 20 years for the knowledge gained in basic science to become applied in clinical practice. But it's a lot of chores. I'm not a neurophysiologist, I'm not a neurologist, so I had to relearn all that stuff and get excited about relearning biochem and the Krebs cycle and mitochondrial bioenergetics. And let me tell you guys, that is so incredibly important, so exciting. I have so much passion about that biochem that hopefully you guys actually know quite a bit better than I do. But hopefully I can ignite that passion and enthusiasm in a couple of weeks when I come back. Yeah? Well, I tell them that they will have to find it themselves. Look, reflect on what are the opportunities that this illness is giving them. And I ask them. There's nothing I can say, but there are questions I can ask. How will this affect your kids, and what benefits might this have for your family? And what benefit might they gain from watching how you deal with this? Those are the questions that because it's not statements that help your patients, it's questions. More questions? Yes.
So when you started thinking your own health care in your own hands,
yeah.
I'm gonna go ahead and see that you have patients.
Yes. Oh, you know, those are terrific questions. So what is the risk for harm? What is the risk for benefit? When people can do a number of things themselves with alternative medicines, with nutrition, with vitamins, with supplements. And so part of our questions will be thinking about the potential for harms. Because of the risk for contamination, my approach to that is getting a CBC, a liver function panel, and a kidney function panel twice a year. Talking about, do you feel better on them or not? And the quickest way to tell is to stop them for 2 weeks and do you feel better or not? So that's very helpful. When people are trying to do things that have a greater likelihood of adverse event, it will depend on the intervention. Then we can talk about what I see as a potential downside risk. Close monitoring for potential toxicities is the best way to go. And reminding them that they're doing self-experimentation. And sometimes it works and sometimes it is disastrous. Certainly there are physicians who have killed themselves doing self-experimentation. And their partners who assisted them have been tried for murder. So physician self-experimentation has gone on probably since we've been physicians. Sometimes it works well, as it did in my case, and sometimes people die, and sometimes their friends and partners who assisted them lose their licenses and go to jail. So it's not without hazard. Yes? Well, no, but it is being studied by me. I have some protocols approved by the Institutional Review Board. I have another protocol where we will be testing my interventions in people with MS and Parkinson's. That's getting close to approval. I receive calls from around the globe, people pleading to be in my study, and I have to say, well, you can't be in that one. There's this one you could be in through the internet. Science is painfully slow because we're very reductionistic. The present science likes to limit variables down to a very narrow set that you can study. But, of course, we are far more complicated. All that biochemistry you learn is not just one little equation. There are trillions of reactions going on instantly in about a trillion cells. So, anyway. So the answer is no one else is, but I am. Go ahead. One more question. Okay, but remember, I'm coming back in a couple of weeks. You guys can think about that. Yeah. Well, you know, right now I'm getting my study funding through the sweat of my brow, which is how you all get started, I assure you. And we're writing NIH grants, we're writing grants to the MS Society. And as our preliminary data comes in, I'm confident we'll get funding. But, you know, all science has to be, you have to start with the sweat of your brow. And then when you get positive results, then you can get funding. Thank you very much. It was a real pleasure being with you.
Thanks for joining us today with Dr. Walls.